is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Tuesday, August 27, 2019. I'm Buster Olney, and our producer, of course, Troy Farkas, back in Bristol. And Troy, you told me before we got started, last night was a late night for you, and I'm curious, what time was that, like 2, 3 in the morning, given the fact that you're, you know, 23 years old?
Buster, I was out and about until about 10:30 last night.
10:30, late night.
Yeah, 10:30. Yeah. Some late night affairs.
My next door neighbor, Joe DiMarzo, is 86, okay? And he's up way later than you are. Think about that.
Hey, I'm just trying to live my best life, Buster.
A late night is 10:30. Come on, man. What is
that? It was a Monday night, though. 10:30 on a Monday. That's crazy. That's wild. That's insane.
10:30 is a late night. Oh, my God. Boy, I usually feel old. Now I'm feeling really young. Like, the fact that I stay up later past, that's unbelievable. Late night, 10:30. All right. News and notes of the day. The original Tampa Bay Rays owner, Vince Dimboli, passed away at age 81. The team said on Monday that he died Sunday, nearly 5 years after being diagnosed with an uncommon brain disorder. The Rockies and the Braves played a makeup game on Monday afternoon. The Rockies led 1-0, top of the ninth inning, and this happened.
Runners going. Sends it to right. That's going to bring in the run easily. We are tied. The sack fly for Echeverria, and finally we're getting offense.
That from the Braves television network. And yeah, you heard the crowd there. It was in Colorado. Those are a lot of Braves fans out there representing a team that's played really well this year, but the Rockies would recover from that blown save.
Blevins delivers, and Mac delivers down the right field line. Stay up, ball! Gone! A line shot! Game-winning homer! Touch of all time, Ryan McMahon!
850 KOA, Dodgers and Padres in the bottom of the sixth inning. It was 3-3. Manny Machado broke that tie.
Here's the 1-0 to Manny. Hard hit grounder to the right side. A look at home for Muncy, but he'll go to first. RBI ground out. And the game is now 4-3. Padres with their first lead of the night.
Oh, how quickly the tie turns.
That from 97.3, the Fan. And that would be the final score, 4-3. And by the end of the night, the Dodgers would fall back into a tie for the best record in baseball. The Brewers have been playing really poorly lately. The Cardinals, on the other hand, are streaking, and St. Louis took off in the top of the second inning against Milwaukee on Monday night.
The pitch on the way. Ozuna rips it to right field. Fair! The ball goes to the corner. Fowler and Edmonds score. Here comes Goldschmidt. He's digging for the plate. He makes it on a bases-loaded double by Marcelo Ozuna.
John Rooney on the Cardinals radio network. St. Louis wins 12-2, beating up on Gio Gonzalez in this start. The Diamondbacks beat the Giants 6-4 with help from the very underrated Eduardo Escobar.
Bases loaded, two outs. Anderson on a 2-2 pitch to Eduardo Escobar. And it's lined into right center field. That's a hit. It's going to score a couple. Heading to third, Marte. Kelly scored. Also coming in, LeCastro, a two-run single for Escobar.
Greg Schulte, Arizona Sports, 98.7 FM. Oakland blew out the Marlins 19-4, and Marcus Semien had himself a day.
Now here's the 1-1 pitch, and that swung and hit to right center, up the alley, nobody's there. One run is in, Davis has scored, Profar's around third, he's going to trot home. Fegley's at third, they're going to wave him, he's going to score, the throw goes to third, it's a triple by Semien driving in three, and the A's have a 5-0 lead in the top of the second.
The 2-0, swung on and belted to deep left, Gordon turns, takes a look, and into the fountains for Marcus Semien. A three-run shot, a 6 RBI night, and it's 10-2 Oakland.
Those calls from 8:60 a.m. The Answer. The Yankees, the final series of their West Coast swing in Seattle, and Gleyber Torres continues to add on to his big numbers.
And Torres drives that high and deep to center field. Fraley back, looking up, and it is gone. Gleyber Torres launches his 33rd home run of the year, on the first pitch thrown by Malone.
Ryan Rucco on the YES Network. Now, there was an unusual ejection in this game in the bottom of the second.
3-2.
Wow.
Okay, I'm not real pleased. Oh, and he just got thrown out of the game. He threw a glove back and it hit Manny Gonzalez, and Manny just ran him.
Root Sports Northwest Television, Dave Sims with that call. Yeah, Cam Broxton was ejected. His helmet came off. The bat went down. And he threw his gloves backwards, and he accidentally hit the home plate umpire in the face, which he acknowledged after the game was his mistake. The Yankees win this game 5-4.
Deep center field.
The game.
It's gone!
Of the day.
Game of the day in Philadelphia. The Phillies and the Pirates. Philadelphia fighting for a playoff spot in the National League. And on this night, Bryce Harper, been away on paternity list as he became a father for the first time, he returned to their lineup, and the Phillies trailed 4-2, bottom of the eighth inning. Harper came to the plate.
A high fly ball to deep right center field. Cabrera going back. It is off the top of the fence. Now they're saying it's a home run.
Tom McCarthy, NBC Sports, Philadelphia. The rally would continue for the Phillies. Runner on base, Corey Dickerson at the plate.
1-2. There he goes, Paul. Deep to right field. No doubt about it. The Phillies have taken the lead here in the bottom of the eighth inning. It's a 5-4 game.
The old friend, John Kruk, adding some color there. The Phillies took that lead into the top of the ninth inning, 5-4. And you know what? The Pirates punch back.
And he swings and sends one deep out to center. And this one is gone. A home run for Josh Bell. He ties the game with a soaring home run to center. His 33rd, and we're knotted at 5.
That from Sports Radio 93.7, The Fan. The Phillies threatened in the bottom of the ninth inning, loading the bases, but they were unable to score. In the bottom of the 11th, it was still 5-all.
Next pitch, swung on, hit deep. Down the left field line towards the corner. This ball is gone. It clears and it's over. Sean Rodriguez with a bullet out to left, right down the line. It's his fourth career walk-off home run. Phillies win it in 11-6-5, the final.
Scott Fransky, Sports Radio 94 WIP. You know that felt good for ex-Pirate Sean Rodriguez to hit that walk-off. So the Phillies win their game. We'll be talking about the National League playoff race coming up with Dave Schoenfield. A great conversation with Alex Anthopoulos, the general manager of the Atlanta Braves, about what happened at the trade deadline. And Sarah Langs will play the numbers game. Let's get to it.
Welcome to the show!
Welcome to the show.
Welcome to the show.
Welcome to the show.
Welcome to the show!
Welcome to the show, mate.
Welcome to the show! Whoa!
Welcome to the show, baby.
You're in the show with David Schoenfield.
David Schoenfield, of course, of ESPN. We're in the show this week, and we got to start with this, Dave, so I can report to my son, who, of course, last week locked in on you to air his grievance about the Braves dropping to number 8 in the power poll for ESPN. The Braves jumped 3 spots after their weekend sweep of the Mets. Where did you personally have the Braves in this week's power poll?
Well, just for your son, I put them 4th, but man, they've been so hot. They've won or tied 9 series in a row. I thought about moving them up to number 3. Couldn't quite do it. I still think it's Dodgers, Yankees, Astros in some order, but I think the Braves, with their recent hot play, as your son would point out, a strong number 4 this week.
Yeah, and because he's 15, he's going to complain about everything. Well, actually, based on what we saw with Andrew Luck this week, at any age, people are complaining about everything. He was wondering, you know, how could people put the Twins ahead of the Braves? The Braves are clearly better. I was like, big man, I don't know if I would necessarily agree with that. But he'll be very happy to hear that you have the Braves that high. And we're going to be talking with Alex Anthopoulos, their general manager, coming up here. But I you know, noted Paul Imbecchini sent out a stat yesterday about how since May 11th, I think the date is, or maybe it's May 14th, the Washington Nationals are 54-26. So they're basically playing 66-67 ball over the course of 3 months, half a season. And yet, incredibly, Dave, the Braves have held firm. Like, their lead is so, can still continue to be very sturdy in the National League East.
Yeah, and look, one reason we saw this on Sunday with those two home runs, Josh Donaldson got off to a slow start. Maybe he was still rusty from, you know, the injuries last year. He's played like the MVP, Josh Donaldson, from a few years ago. He's been tearing it up for 2+ months now. So you have three big bats in that lineup with Donaldson, Freeman, and Acuna. They can score runs, even though they're banged up. Dansby Swanson just came back last night. That'll help. Their rotation, remember, was terrible at the start of the year, especially the back end. They've solidified that a little bit, especially with, you know, this Dallas Keuchel fight. And the bullpen hasn't been great. It's middle of the pack. And I think a lot of people think their bullpen's been terrible, but it's middle of the pack. It's hung in there. So, yeah, it's just a deep team. That I know they were your preseason pickbuster, so maybe this isn't that big of a surprise if they're this good.
Yeah, Josh Donaldson's the top of my list of things that I was going to ask Alex about, because he, of course, traded for him when he was general manager of the Blue Jays and then reinvested in him for this year's team. And I agree with your assessment 100% about their bullpen, but I got to say, as I look at, and I think you'll agree with me, what contending team has a good bullpen? Like, yeah, a great bullpen. I think, you know, when I was watching the Yankees on Sunday Night Baseball, that bullpen is a great bullpen. I don't know if any other contending team has a great bullpen, because even the Dodgers, you know, Kenley Jansen, real questions about his performance. Joe Kelly has been terrific the last 3 months, but let's face it, we get into October, it's a different game, and you wonder if he's going to be as good as he was with the Red Sox last year, or more like he was at the beginning of the year. And Pedro Baez reminded us again on Sunday night that he's capable of being up and down. So I don't even know if there's a National League team that has a great bullpen.
No, which is why, you know, once we get to October and we try to predict that what's going to happen in the playoffs,
yeah,
here, forget it. We can't predict what's going to happen because of those bullpens. And maybe that makes the Yankees a little better in October, you know, as great as they've been in the regular season, they might even be a better October team. Yeah, I can't remember a year like this where so many playoff teams will have just huge concerns up and down the bullpen. It's crazy.
Right. You're down in New York. You saw the U.S. Open yesterday. Later today, the Mets and Cubs begin what I think is an absolutely potentially a crossroads series. And I think there's more potential in that for the Mets than the Cubs. But let's face it, as this series begins, both of these teams desperately in need of traction. The Cardinals have been playing well. The Cubs are drifting back in the National League Central. And the Mets face a situation after they were swept 3 games over the weekend by the Braves. If the Mets were to actually get swept by the Cubs this week, that may effectively finish them. What do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I was down there last week when they swept the Indians, and they really, you know, Cleveland came in as maybe the hottest team in baseball. Mets really beat them up pretty good, and they're all happy, and, you know, the crowds were loud and enthusiastic and big, and it's like, it's 50 years later since the Miracle Mets. The whole city was like, we're going to do it again. And then the Braves come in and sweep them, and suddenly the Mets are in a little more trouble than they were 4 days ago. Yeah, I'm with you. Huge series. You know, up until this weekend, the Mets had been great at home all year. The Cubs, of course, as we know, have been terrible on the road. So I certainly would not predict a Cubs sweep. I would, if there is a sweep, I think it might be the Mets. I know they did score runs this weekend, but their rotation's been really, really good lately. I don't think the Mets are going to fall out of it after with this series.
According to Fangraphs, the Mets' chances for winning a wild card spot down to 32.6%. Interestingly, the Phillies were ahead of the Mets in the standings. Their chances assessed by Fangraphs at 9.2%. Some of these statistical models, systems that are used, Dave, they make you scratch your head a little bit, but that's where we stand as we begin that series. So I want to ask you about the American League Cy Young Award race, which is fascinating because it looks like it's going to come down to two guys who are teammates now and three guys who were teammates last year. You have Justin Verlander, Garrett Cole of the Houston Astros, and Charlie Morton. And tonight, Charlie Morton of the Rays scheduled to pitch in Houston against Verlander. And last week, after the most recent starts for Verlander, Garrett Cole, their numbers were basically identical. It's incredible that you see contenders have numbers that are this similar. The ERA for Garrett Cole, 2.75. The ERA for Justin Verlander, 2.77. Verlander has one more strikeout than Garrett Cole. And while we don't use wins and losses the way we did, say, 30 years ago in assessing Cy Young candidates, they're identical, 15-5. But the more that I thought about this, Dave, I feel like that Garrett Cole right now has an upper hand and maybe even a strong upper hand, because in recent years we've seen the voters really like guys trending stronger toward the end of the year, maybe like picking the NCAA field. And there's no doubt that Garrett Cole, since May 11th, has been trending better than Verlander. Since then, a 2.13 ERA. He has 164 strikeouts in 114 innings. If I were to pick one of those two guys today, I would pick Garrett Cole. What about you?
Yeah, I saw a stat the other day that it bothered me a little, and it probably shouldn't, because this is the way pitchers are handled in 2019. Garrett Cole hasn't pitched in the eighth inning all year, but he's still, first or second in the Cy Young race. Yeah, I think Verlander, the number that pops out at me is that 33 home runs allowed. Cole, a little better at 24. So I think as a tiebreaker, I also do look at that home run total. And I know Verlander, he's kept his ERA down because it's been a lot of solo home runs. But I'm with you. I give a slight edge at the moment to Garrett Cole, but it can certainly change the last five or six starts.
If you were filling out a Cy Young ballot, rank in order the statistics that matter the most for you.
Well, it's still about runs allowed, and I know there's some flaws in ERA. You need good team defense, and there could be some luck in there. But I go ERA, then I go innings pitched, and then I go strikeouts. Are you dominant? And that's where Charlie Morton is a clear third. He doesn't have the strikeouts that Cole and Verlander. But look, it's all about run prevention, however you dissect it. The goal is to not allow the other team to score, but that's why it's close. They're neck and neck in ERA right now.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. That's the first number I go to, and I get it that the statistics are becoming more evolved. I would say this. This year demonstrates for me that maybe wins above replacement for pitchers is not necessarily a great number, because Max Scherzer missed the better part of a month, and he's still, I think, the last I checked, running away with that. That seems a little odd. And Lance Lynn, according to Wins Above Replacement, should win the American League Cy Young Award. And while I know Troy Farkas is backing his Texas Ranger, Lance Lynn, I'm sorry, he's not the best pitcher in the American League. What do you think?
I mean, I think he should win the Cy Young based on give him the Cy Young, give him comeback player of the year, and give him a new contract, team-friendly, of course.
Wow, unbelievable. Okay, Dave, what do you think of Troy?
Yeah, the Fangraphs reading on Lynn and Minor are interesting. I think there's some severe park effects going on there in their evaluation. The Fangraphs numbers also, they rely on FIP, fielding independent pitching, which basically just looks at home runs and strikeouts as far and workload. So Verlander and Cole are going to fare very well as Scherzer, because they rack up the strikeouts. Look, yeah, every pitcher, you want to strike out every batter, right? That's a perfect game if you strike out 27 guys, but that's not factoring in when are you giving up your hits. If you're struggling with guys on base, your ERA is going to be higher than your FIP, and thus you're going to allow more runs. The Lance Lynn thing, I guess that's worth investigating. It's kind of sticks out as a number that doesn't make a lot of sense this year.
All right, Hall of Famer Ken Griffey Jr. was on SportsCenter speaking with Scott Van Pelt, and I don't even know what he said. I haven't heard this clip, Dave, but I know you being a Seattle guy, I knew I'd want to play what he said for you, and then we'll talk about what he said and what we think. Give a listen.
You still got to hit it, whether they got the launch angle or not. My job at my swing was to make good solid contact.
Sure.
And if it happens to go out, it goes out. If it doesn't, it doesn't. But my era was when, getting on base was just as important as hitting a home run, and probably more important. Nowadays, the guys think about driving the ball out the ballpark. But if you look at it, when you hit the ball out the ballpark, what does that next guy do? Does he have a letdown because there's nobody on? Ricky Henderson did a great job of getting on base and, you know, helping his team out, being that ultimate leadoff hitter and putting pressure on the defense. I think that there's a little bit of, you know, the guys nowadays don't know how to put pressure on defense.
What do you think about that? And it's interesting, but of course, he was a teammate with Alex Rodriguez, who I worked with on Sunday Night Baseball, and Alex feels the same way, I think, in watching the game.
Yeah, well, I guess I'm happy that it wasn't – I was expecting the old man rant, right? Get off my lawn. Today's baseball is terrible. It wasn't quite in that direction, so that's good. I agree. I mean, look, we all know all the home runs that have been hit this year. It's turned the game into, and I think you're going to agree, into too one-dimensional of a game. I like the variety of action that we had in the 80s, and even in the steroid era, guys were still stealing 50-plus bases. You don't see that anymore. Although Ken Griffey Jr., it's funny, he always called himself a line drive hitter, but he became an ultimate launch angle guy. Look at his ground ball to fly ball ratio. He went up there after his first few years and tried to hit home runs because he was really good at hitting home runs. So it's not like guys didn't learn to launch the ball back in the day either.
No, and it's funny you mention that because I remember covering a game when he was playing in Yankee Stadium, and in each of his plate appearances in this particular game, he was trying to hit home runs. And I remember Mike Stanton was a reliever for the Yankees at the time. They all realized that, and so they just began to elevate the ball more and more and more and more. And he kept on trying to hit home runs. He could do that better than anybody. I was there in Camden Yards when he won. I don't know if he actually won that home run derby, but when he became the first person to ever hit the warehouse on the fly. Yeah, he was tremendous. And before we go, you know, as I listened to him and I thought about his swing and he was talking about launch angle and that sort of thing, I think you and I should start a process today, Dave, if you want, where we could vote for an updated version of the MLB logo, maybe Ken Griffey Jr. replacing Harmon Killebrew, the iconic Hall of Famer, as the logo, because nobody had a more beautiful swing than Ken Griffey Jr. What do you think?
Hey, you know I'm going to be in favor of that. I'm with you. I mean, come on. No offense to Harmon Killebrew, a lot of 40 homer seasons, but yeah, Ken Griffey Jr., perfect swing. Make him the logo. I'm with you.
And you know what? Have the cap on backwards.
There
you know what
you
I mean?
Go.
How cool would that be? If you want to make it younger.
You want to get kids interested in the game, so jazz it up a little.
You know what? That sounds like a pretty cool article on ESPN.com.
Let's do it. We'll flip a coin on who gets to write it.
There we go. All right, Dave. Thanks for doing this.
All right. Thanks, Buster.
Before we speak with Alex Anthopoulos, do you ever feel like ticketing websites make getting to the event difficult on purpose? It's as if they're so big they can get away with not caring about the customer experience. The real question is, how easy could it be if those ticketing sites actually cared? With millions of live event tickets and a price match guarantee, SeatGeek proves there's a better way. Search sports, live music, comedy, and more. SeatGeek has the tickets you're looking for all in one place. They built the fastest way to find tickets. You can stop searching for the perfect seat, start enjoying it. Why is SeatGeek better than the rest? It's a better process. SeatGeek pulls together millions of tickets from all over the web. Then it rates each deal on a scale of 1 to 10. Finally, SeatGeek displays them on an interactive seat map. SeatGeek breaks down the details. Green dots mean good deals. Red dots are overpriced. And every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets with confidence. And I did that recently. Getting WHO tickets for September 13th at Fenway Park. And I can tell you this, Troy, I'm going to be out there a little bit later than 10:30. Okay, my late night, even in my advanced age, is going to be a lot later than your late night at 23.
Wow. You just got to start the day earlier. See, that's what I do. Everyone always wants to go out. Hey, let's go out like 9, 10 o'clock. I'm like, no, let's start at 7. That's better. Just start it all earlier.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought you see you were playing that early morning card. You can't do that with me, buddy.
you win. You're a machine. I admit it.
All right. SeatGeek will even give you $10 off your first SeatGeek purchase. All you need to do is use our promo code. Download the SeatGeek app today and use promo code BUSTER for $10 off on your first purchase. That's promo code BUSTER for $10 off on your first purchase.
Alex Anthopoulos is the general manager of the Atlanta Braves. Of course, lead the National League East. And Alex, how you doing today?
Doing well. Thanks for having me on.
Last offseason, you moved quickly in striking a deal with Josh Donaldson, and it was the second time in your career as an executive that he invested in him, and he's having a terrific season. You know, he hit 32 home runs this year. What made you, convinced you early on that he'd be someone who could bounce back from the injury issues that he had with the Blue Jays?
So we had, you know, we were looking for a middle of the order bat. In terms of free agency, there was three in our minds: Harper, Machado, and Donaldson. Obviously, the first two were going to take significant, lengthy deals. Harper having a qualifying offer test on top of it, and Donaldson, we felt like, though not in the same place in his career, no, those guys were 26. He had as much upside as those guys had a chance to be, you know, from an offensive standpoint, defensive standpoint, you know, as good if not beyond those guys for 2019. So I think the big thing is having the training staff here that was here in Toronto when he first got there that knew him well. The fact that he came back at the end of the year with the Indians, and even though it was a small sample and he didn't necessarily play every day, but that September was really big as well. And just knowing the person, the makeup, before those two times, he had never been on the IL prior to 2017, 2018, and even 2017, he still put together a fantastic year. So he had never been hurt before. This is a guy that had been durable his entire career. I do believe there's a mentality that comes with that. Now, when you break down with your body, you break down. But if his body could just get right, and we felt like it had a very good chance of doing so, we knew he'd be out there. And all the indicators in September were that he still had it in him. The exit velocities were still good. His walk rate was still good, things like that. And then just knowing the makeup, the drive, the work ethic, and also the fact that he was willing to bet on himself and do a one-year deal. I mean, that, obviously clubs try to do one-year deals with guys, and you can tell when they kind of shy away. And knowing Josh and how confident he is, and he was very comfortable doing it, and he believed that he can have a great year. So far, 5 months into it, it's been great for us.
Yeah, and you mentioned his drive. He's someone who always plays with an edge. And look, front offices don't care about emotional stuff as much as they did maybe 20 years ago. But how much did you put into how his personality would play with your other guys? Because I thought when I saw it, I was like, boy, he's a great complement to the other guys that they have.
I think it's real. I think early on in my career as a GM, I didn't pay attention to it. I think, you know, you would call around and, oh, this guy's a good guy, bad guy, whatever it might be, and that would be it. But I think I just started to pay attention to more to fit. I mean, there's plenty of good players and so on, and certain players thrive in certain environments and certain clubhouses. And I don't think you can have too much of one type of individual. You're not going to have 25 of the same type of guy. But I did feel like how intense he is, how competitive he is, how accountable he holds himself and also his teammates as well. With the mix that we had with guys like Freddie Freeman, Nick Markakis, Brian McCann, he was a great mix of those guys. And obviously, he needs to go out on the field and to perform as well. But we definitely talked a lot. You know, the fact that he grew up a Braves fan, you know, lived pretty close, it was going to mean something to him as well. There would be a comfort level with the training staff as well. You know, all those things were something we really talked a lot about, that he'd really be a good fit for us.
As a baseball fan, I've always wondered what Billy Hamilton would be like on a contending team because he just has the impact speed, and you guys picked him up. What did you see in him adding? And you know, was October in the back of your mind as you made that deal?
You know, for us, we were DFA. We weren't really planning on pursuing him. We had Andrew Ciarte that went down. We had Ortega, who was in AAA for us, doing a nice job, but we just thought if Ciarte takes the entire month of September, we still have a lot of games left. Should something happen to one of our center fielders, then at that point, we don't have any coverage at all. And then, you know, more importantly, though, as a bench piece, to be able to pinch run, defensive replacement, we've been playing Matt Joyce quite a bit against right-handers now with just all the injuries that we sustained with Riley and Markakis and Ciarte. So we figured it was a pretty good spot for him to come in late in the game, play defense, come in late in the game to hopefully steal a base. And our view was more, if he can help us win a game or two with the way the NL East is going and all these tough games we have coming up in September, you know, he might really help us swing the balance to get back into the playoffs. So we didn't think that far ahead to October. I hope it's something that we talk about in October at that point, but we're just so locked in on trying to get in, and more importantly, just trying to win the East.
What do you think that the industry learned about the new July 31st trade deadline this year? And would you be among those who'd be in favor of maybe nudging it backward?
Well, I think I wear two hats on this thing. So from a personal, selfish GM standpoint, I liked having the month of August. I thought it was still fun and exciting. And still, you still can make trades. You still can be creative. There were some big players that have been moved in the past, like Verlander and so on, in past years in the month of August, which I thought was still exciting. I also understand from a player standpoint, for the most part, they know once the 31st of July comes and goes, they don't have to worry about it. They get to stay put, and they get to breathe a sigh of relief. I also think from a parity standpoint, there was a lot of clubs that were on the fence with 2 months left that didn't want to sell or strip their teams down. So I do think for the last 2 months, there'll be more competitive games, more competitive teams, especially for the month of September. So as challenging as it is as a GM, and the fact that when you have guys get hurt and you've come so far, it's harder to make changes and so on, I actually think it's good for the game and the competitiveness rather than having teams that continue to strip down at the end of August and so on, which makes September with the expanded rosters and so on not really the same game.
It always felt like to me that in August that the big market teams always had an advantage because they could potentially add more money. Do you think that that there's going to be a discussion this fall about, you know, at least a review process about how the July 31st deadline played out?
You know, I don't know. I guess I'll be curious when we get to the GM meetings, you know, if that topic does come up. I mean, I think everyone went in with their eyes wide open. Everyone knew the rules. I know from our standpoint, we tried to do a little bit more than we normally would have done at the end of July, just knowing that you don't want to have any regrets come August. And you can't really know what's going to happen, obviously, with players getting hurt, downturn in performance. I think just internally, we've talked about it a little bit. I think there's one little tweak we might change and some things we might look to do for next year. But I think for the most part, it went the way everybody expected. I think where you really start to lament and miss the old rules is where you're in our spot and players start going down, players start getting hurt, and they're going to be out for a while, and you really have nowhere to turn. And sure, you need depth. You try to stockpile it during the winter, but you need depth for just during the year to get through the year. And now you have an added layer of depth you need to try to find, especially when you're only dealing with 25 guys. So it's challenging, but we're all playing with the same rules, and I do think it's good for the game as hard as it is for me to say that with the guys that we've had get hurt.
You mentioned the one little tweak. What would that be?
I wouldn't want to say just because I think it's a small thing, but I think it's a little competitive advantage that we could have done, something that we didn't talk about and foresee. So I'm not trying to be cryptic or say this is some huge thing. I just think we could have done some things maybe to create a little more insurance for us. I think there's something there that we look back and we would have maybe added a player or two in a certain spot a certain way. So, you know what, I can't really get into the details of it. I think, you know, a year from now, hopefully I'm still here and everything's going well. But, you know, if we were to make a move like that, I'll be able to explain to you then. This is what I talked about a year ago at this time.
You guys are playing the Blue Jays now, and of course, you know, your history is with the Blue Jays, and you get a lot of questions about that. But you also spent some time with the Dodgers. What was your takeaway from that time working with Andrew Friedman and his staff?
Yeah, that was great. I mean, obviously, my time in Toronto was tremendous. Loved every minute and got amazing experience. And then I was really grateful that LA called and offered me a job, and getting to work with Andrew and Farhan Zaidi for those 2 years. I wish it had been 4 or 5, but you know, the Atlanta opportunity came up, and it was something that was too good to turn down. But I just think, one, being somewhere where I just got to learn a ton, and I just think I got so much better. And beyond the fact that it's a great place to live and great organization, and Andrew and Farhan were so great to me and my family, we moved out there, and I planned on being there for a long period of time, and you know, being around teams that have a chance to win day in and day out. But they're just so well run. The organization is so strong. They're in such good hands. And I think just a lot of things I took away from there. And I just like I said, if I had a few more years, that would have been great. But the 2 years that I got from there, I don't think I would give those up for the world. I think I got a lot better for my current role.
Last one for you. Speaking of the Dodgers, I feel like that an underrated part of what they've done and what the Yankees have done is identify, for lack of a better way to describe them, sort of diamonds in the rough. The guys like Max Muncy and Chris Taylor, and you were there when the Dodgers added Chris Taylor and helped him out, the Yankees with Michael Tauchman and other players like that. Why do you think that that they've had that kind of success with that?
You know, I can't obviously speak to New York, but, you know, I can say just speaking to Andrew and Farhan specifically, I mean, both of those guys came from small market clubs. You look at Oakland's done it quite a bit, Tampa for years. The work that Andrew did there speaks for itself, you know, competing against them in the AL East, winning divisions, into the playoffs. So, I mean, they've been able to combine the best of both worlds, and then, you know, they also were able to sign some big contracts. And they've done a very good job with scouting and player development. So I'm not surprised just being there and seeing how they did things. I think they're obsessed with having depth. I think they're obsessed with making sure every player gets better, whether that's 1%, 5%, whatever it might be. And I think just having a strong 40-man roster at all times is something that they really prioritize.
Alex, thanks for doing this. You guys are playing great.
I hope we can keep it going tonight, but thanks for the time.
Numbers game.
Sarah Langs is a reporter and a producer for MLB.com. And Sarah, I just want to get your opinion on this thing that popped up organically in my conversation with Dave. We all know that the MLB logo for years has been Harmon Killebrew, Hall of Famer, great Hall of Famer, and no disrespect to him. I do wonder if it might be a good time to update the logo. And I thought a perfect candidate. How about Ken Griffey Jr. had the most beautiful swing ever. Just at that moment when he struck the ball, and my addendum to that, besides having Ken Griffey Jr. for being the logo, how about having the cap backwards to appeal to kids? What do you think?
I love that. I feel like I've seen that image on Twitter. You know, every now and then people decide to Photoshop very random things we see around, and I feel like people like to mess with those logos sometimes. You see it for MLB, you see it for NBA, and I feel like I've seen that. I can envision exactly what it would be. I think that would be fun. Why not? I mean, we saw, you know, different logos, different things going on with Players Weekend and everything else. I like it. I like change.
All right, let's play the numbers game.
Number three
is 99. So that's how many career home runs Aaron Judge is now sitting at after he homered in all three games of that Dodgers series. If he gets to 100 in his next five games, he'd have the third fewest games to 100 career home runs of any player in MLB history. And, of course, we just saw his teammate Gary Sanchez get there in 355 games, which was the second fewest. The only guy quicker than that in terms of games was Ryan Howard, 325 games to get to 100 career home runs. So obviously it's commentary a bit on the state of the game, but pretty cool for these current Yankees that they'd have number two and three in terms of fewest games to 100 career home runs.
Number two
is 64. So speaking of all of those home runs that the Yankees have been hitting, they've hit 64 home runs in August, which is a single month MLB record. The prior record was 58, so they have broken this and then some. And just for a little context here, and I'm sorry to the Marlins, but the Marlins hit 64 home runs from the start of the season through the end of June. And the Yankees have hit 64 home runs in a single month. And again, we have seen these kinds of records fall this year, but I still think it's pretty crazy to think about that. That is a lot of home runs in 1 month, which still has 3 days left.
Number one
is 105. So Jorge Soler had a home run and three strikeouts on Sunday, which was the 105th time this season where a player had at least one home run and at least three strikeouts in a game. That total, 105, ties the 2017 season for the most such games in a single season in MLB history. And, of course, it's just late August. So, again, to the point, honestly, in all of these numbers today, it's showing kind of these trends that we've seen really growing and maybe growing exponentially over the last few years, increased strikeouts, increased home runs, this idea that they go together. But I think it's pretty interesting because three strikeouts is not a good day, but a home run is a pretty good day, and it kind of shows how that definition is maybe changing, or at least what we're seeing so frequently is changing.
It feels like we should name that. Find a player who is a model of that. You know, we talk about the Mendoza line, where if anyone is hitting below 200, we need to identify a player who most commonly has a home run and three strikeouts and say, hey, you pulled off a Dave Kingman or whoever that would be appropriate for in 2019. Before you go, you know, Mets-Cubs, big series. It feels like that both these teams have so much at stake. A sweep either way would be devastating for the loser. How you feeling?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I feel like it's a conglomeration of a lot of storylines, right? We have the Cubs don't play well on the road. We have the Mets who swept a really good team in the Indians and then got swept by a very good team in the Braves. So, you know, we'll see what happens. But I would say that this is one of those almost make or break kind of series for the Mets, right? I mean, they're throwing, theoretically, their three best pitchers, right? In Stroman, who hasn't been absolutely great for them yet, but certainly has been good. Syndergaard, who's been really good his last five starts. And then Jacob DeGrom, who is Jacob DeGrom. They're facing Yu Darvish, Kyle Hendricks, and John Lester. Maybe Lester struggling a bit, but certainly those are three of the best pitchers for the Cubs. So, you know, I really don't know. I have expressed my reservations. I don't think the Mets are quite as good as that little 15-1 stretch showed, but this would certainly be a statement series. Now, I don't know if you can take it to be the end-all be-all if they do beat them, because we've seen how much the Cubs have struggled on the road, but certainly I think avoiding a sweep on either end feels like what needs to happen here.
All right, Sarah. Good luck with the series. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks so much for having me, Buster.
Bleacher Tweets.
Okay, Buster, we have some fine Bleacher Tweets for you this morning. The first one comes from Ben Swinnerton at Swinnerton B. I'm reading Trevor Bauer's comments about how the game is covered, and he seems right. TV coverage on any network would improve with more focus on pitch sequence and game situations. It makes the fan more educated and engaged. What's your reaction, Buster?
Ben, Troy, who's a better pitcher, me or Trevor Bauer?
Probably Trevor Bauer.
Probably Trevor Bauer, okay? And I'd say this, who has a better feel for how to present information in a public forum, me or Trevor Bauer?
Buster Olney.
I would say that's the case. I can tell you this, he's absolutely wrong. I can't imagine how my 15-year-old son, who's a big sports fan, loves to watch the Braves. If we started to go on the broadcast, well, 36% of the time, there is a curveball thrown here, but it might be better if he throws a slider, because 28% of the time he swings, oh my God, would eyes glaze over. And I can understand. Trevor watches the game at an advanced level, and I don't think people would be able to keep up with that, and I think they would find that to be a colossal bore. What do you think, Troy?
I do think the same thing that you just said. However, I think if, it would make a great ESPN Plus series, maybe a detail thing. So, next one comes from Montgomery Bopp at MJBopp24. The Yankees' starting pitching has been a huge weakness, but they're first in runs scored and have the best record against teams over 500. Are these stats being undervalued when considering how they stack up against other powerhouse teams?
I do. It's funny. I do feel like the Yankees are underrated because of the questions about their rotation. I think people say, well, of course that they would lose to the Astros, who, you know, had clearly on paper have a better rotation. But the rest of that team is so good. In fact, I had someone in the Red Sox organization this summer say to me, there's no doubt in his mind that the Yankees are the best team in baseball right now. We'll just have to wait and see how that plays out.
Yeah, especially when we get to the postseason, all the pitching, the normal conventions totally go out the window. So who knows what will happen then. Next one comes from Jake Eichert at the great Jake 37. Similar to when Cole Hamels hit Bryce Harper and admitted to doing it, should Max Muncy get suspended for admitting to faking an injury to prevent Gleyber Torres from scoring?
Yeah, and that happened after Saturday's game. Max Muncy was lying on the dirt, and people thought he was hurt, and he acknowledged afterward that he was kind of playing it up, maybe to get a timeout call, which is exactly what happened and prevented the Yankees from scoring a run. No, you can't suspend him for doing that. It's not that big of a deal.
Next one comes from Justin Simmons at Justin Lance Sim 1. Hey, Buster, any chance the Braves re-sign either Josh Donaldson or Dallas Keuchel?
We know this. Alex Anthopoulos, as we talked about, has invested multiple times in Josh Donaldson. He appreciates him. Maybe they'll work something out. Same thing with Keuchel. The one thing about the Braves is they do have a lot of young starting pitching, and that means they probably won't necessarily be desperate in going after Keuchel in the way that maybe some other teams could be.
Last one comes from Shane Christensen at FigJam0 about the team that always stumps us in our Power 10. Why does the media continue to predict the Cubs will win the NL Central based on, quote, superior talent? Haven't we seen enough to know their talent isn't what everyone thought it was?
I don't know, Shane, because you go player by player. Again, you look at their roster, and you just wonder why they're not more consistent, because, you know what, Chris Bryant's having a good year. He's a really great player. Javier Baez is a terrific player. Anthony Rizzo is a really good player. When healthy, Wilson Contreras, a good player. Yu Darvish, no doubt. He's been pitching great. John Lester at his best. He's terrific. And I don't know if I can necessarily say we've been wrong. Looking at the Cubs, how come they're not better? We know this. Cubs front office is looking at them in the exact same way.
Thank you for the tweets this morning. Use the hashtag Bleacher Tweets when you bring them on Twitter.
That's it for today. My thanks to Alex Anthopoulos, to Sarah Langs, to Dave Schoenfield, and to Troy Farkas. Troy, I mean, I know you had a late night last night, 10:30. Woof, you going to bed at like 6 tonight?
That's the plan. That is the plan. I'll have a nice, you know, maybe 2 o'clock dinner and then go to bed, and hopefully around 6, 6:30.
Very nice. Get a good solid 10 hours of sleep. Way to go, man. Have a great day, everybody.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/PodCenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.